52 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Israel Defense Forces saying they've struck more than 2,000 targets in Gaza so far, with entire neighborhoods being destroyed. Rockets are still falling inside of Israel as well. More than 2,300 deaths are reported on both sides. CBS's Holly Williams reports from Tel Aviv.
United in its grief and in the horror of what it's been subjected to, Israel has begun to bury its dead. Rescue workers have reported seeing atrocities at the Kfar Aza kibbutz, a small farming community stormed by Hamas gunmen.
You saw multiple children and babies who'd been beheaded.
Not only children, I saw a lot more that cannot be described.
President Biden says 22 Americans have died in Israel and 17 are unaccounted for. Mr. Biden tells a roundtable with Jewish community leaders.
What are you doing to get these folks home? If I told you, I wouldn't be able to get them home. Folks, there's a lot we're doing. I have not given up hope. I'm bringing these folks home.
In the race to fill the vacant U.S. House Speaker seat, Republicans nominate Majority Leader Steve Scalise, but he still needs full House approval. Congressman Scalise saying,
"We need to make sure we're sending a message to people all throughout the world that the House is open and doing the people's business. And our first resolution we pass under Speaker Steve Scalise will be to make it clear that we stand with Israel."
Three people are recovering after being stabbed at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. WANF-TV's Alan Devlin.
Police say a woman outside the security area stabbed an adult man, another woman, and that police lieutenant who was trying to take her into custody. All those victims are alert, conscious, and breathing right now, and that suspect is in custody.
No word on what sparked it. The Biden administration wants to get rid of junk fees, which can mask the total cost of hotel rooms, utility bills, and concert tickets. But some industries oppose changes.
A one-size-fits-all approach is not the right approach to the rental housing industry.
Greg Brown, a senior vice president with the National Apartment Association, says the group is all for transparency, but not an overall rule change proposed by the Federal Trade Commission on junk fees. Brown says that could raise rental prices.
It inevitably increases the complexity around providing housing. If you're creating more complexity in the housing transaction, that increases the cost of providing that housing.
The White House says it's the junk fees that raise prices by as much as 20%.
Stocks edged higher on Wall Street, the Dow closing up 66 points, NASDAQ up 97. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
On a scale of
Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Another member of Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's panel to investigate impeachment proceedings against newly elected Justice Janet Protasiewicz has publicly recommended not pursuing impeachment. Former Justice John Wilcox was only recently revealed to be a member of the panel alongside former Chief Justice Patience Rogensack and former Justice David Prosser. Both Wilcox and Prosser have publicly said they do not support impeachment proceedings. Law enforcement authorities are looking for a suspect and vehicle involved in two September burglaries. Officials say the suspect is wanted in connection with the theft of money from a pumpkin stand lockbox in Dunn County on September 13th and a burglary at Lake Haley Storage on September 17th. Security footage received does not clearly show the suspect, but does show a 2007 to 2011 Toyota Camry with a partial license plate of 2EU06. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Haller House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Haller House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The Allies have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pin still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Alba Show.
What makes our society great is that we can believe in something bigger than ourselves. Doesn't matter whether it's a soccer team or whether it's a political movement or whether it's a public school, whether it's a neighborhood PTA, a bake sale. It's about interacting with our friends and neighbors and making our communities better for having come together around a common cause.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the... Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Alba Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Facebook's mastodons and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for years here on the program, we've been talking about the economy and how the economy doesn't work for working people. The game seems to be rigged for the wealthy and the well-connected. And recently we've been talking about how inequality is, well, right up there in the Gilded Age levels. And while we can and do spend considerable time talking about all of the problems and pointing out all the problems, I like to talk about the fixes. Is there a way to fix our problems? Is there a way to make things better for working people? Now, personally, I advocate for higher taxes on billionaires. In fact, I don't think we should have any. I agree with Sean Fain. We should eat the rich. We need stronger unions to help workers fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. And, of course, I think we need stronger regulations. Break up these big monopolies. Level the playing field for average, everyday, working-class Americans. But is that enough? Could we do more? Should we do more? Well, here to help us work through some of that is Marjorie Kelly. Marjorie is a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative. They've got a new book out, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. One of the must reads for anyone who wants to think about how we make a better economy for working people. Marjorie, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me. It's a treat to be here.
So, look, let's start at this space. You know, I think, you know, I look to the FDR era. I look to the New Deal era of, hey, you know, we need stronger labor unions. We need better rules. We need higher taxes on rich people to kind of level out the game. Is that enough? Is that our grandparents' economy? What do we do?
Yeah, you said it right there. That's our grandparents' economy. What you're talking about is all the rules, you know, from the 30s and that era of how to regulate capitalism. But it, you know, it's worse today, right? I mean, wages have been stagnant. There's this incredible war on workers. 40% of jobs are now insecure. They're contingent, part-time, gig, and it's going to get worse with artificial intelligence. So, you know, it's hard to unionize somebody when they're subcontracted and then there's a temp agency that, you know, is hiring, going to the subcontractor. Capital interests have succeeded in really decimating worker power. And, you know, we need to climb into the driver's seat, Rick. This is what I'm pointing out here in Wealth Supremacy is that, you know, here's a weirdness of our economy. Workers are not considered members of the corporation. Only capital has a vote inside the corporation. They vote for the CEO. CEO gets paid. CEO gets rich if shareholders get rich. Well, you know, shareholders don't go and do the work of the company. If a worker goes there every day for 30 years, they're not a member of that corporation, but an algorithm holding stock for 10 minutes does have a vote and is a member. So that's crazy. So we need to be talking about worker ownership. We need to be talking about, you know, corporations that are designed to serve workers and the community, and not just designed to serve capital. I mean, that, we need to really move beyond the system as it is right now.
But, you know, someone say, well, now you're talking about socialism. You're talking about worker-owned collaboratives, which we've tried it on small scales. And, you know, there have been, you know, attempts across the globe at this. You know, end up getting crushed by big capital interest. How do we get to that place? You know, look, I'm not against it. I think it'd be a great idea to own the factors of production as a working person, as opposed to just being a negative on a balance sheet. So how do we get to that place?
Well, so let me say two things. First of all, worker ownership, it does work. I mean, Recology is a $1 billion company. It's a waste hauling recycling company in San Francisco. It's 100% owned by workers. Garbage truck drivers make more than $100,000 a year, right? So worker ownership can work at large scale. We also need public ownership of water. And California is looking at public ownership of pharmaceuticals, you know, be doing insulin. So yes, there can be other forms of ownership rather than just having a big capital own it all. But here's the other thing, and that's really important. This is important, Rick, and that is that we have to see that the current system is not legitimate. I mean, we can come up with all of these little gimmicks of how to get from here to there, but until we see that really there's a bias at work here, and this is what I mean by wealth supremacy. The system is biased toward the wealthy and toward capital. And I unpack how that is in very granular ways. This is not hand waving. You can look at the structure of the income statement and corporate governance and accounting rules. And I unpack these in a very accessible way and show you feel like it is rigged. It is rigged. And there are other ways that work that we can move toward.
No, and this is where I keep coming back to, you know, I go back to my grandparents' tax code. I go back to the, you know, the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code of, you know, top marginal rate of 92% and a corporate rate of 56%. Once you have rates like that, you don't have gazillionaires anymore. You have a more distributed income. You have more shared wealth, I think, because it's forced by a government entity saying we're gonna make sure wealth is distributed in a way that's a little bit more fair. I mean, we had rich people, but we didn't have the kind of gazillionaires we've got today.
No, you know, here's a couple of facts that really struck me lately. All of the developing nations in the world, they're struggling with their debt right now. And their rich people and institutional investors own that debt. Right? That debt is owed to somebody. So $300 billion is what Bill Gates has in his personal wealth, $300 billion with a B. And if you took all of the developing nations' debt, it amounts to $200 billion. So this one person could theoretically wipe out all of the debt of these struggling companies, and he would still have $100 billion, which is more money than any of us can even, we can't even count that high. This is how out of whack it's gotten. It's absurd. And here's the other thing. The way that the rules are written right now, corporations have an obligation to maximize the gains of Bill Gates and other capital owners. You know, until we change that, Rick, we're attacking a mountain with teaspoons. I don't think we have recognized how serious the problem is and that we need to move beyond this. And let me give you just a quick example of how we could do that. If we got serious about it, Elizabeth Warren has said the Accountable Capitalism Act, every corporation over $1 billion, they need a new federal charter, which says you have to serve the public good. You're not just serving shareholders anymore. And 40% of board seats are reserved for workers. Now, that would start to be a different kind of game. And yep, that's an example of the kind of thing that we need.
No, I'm all in favor of that. I think that is a great idea. You know, but I also come back to that tax thing,
Yeah,
because I think that's important in that, you know, think of the Gilded Age. You know, who were the robber barons of the Gilded Age? You know,
right.
you could name a bunch of them, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. Rockefeller, Carnegie, Yeah.
Who are you right?
Taxing is important. There's no one silver bullet. I don't want to give that impression. But we need an economy that's designed for all of us, for all of us to thrive and for to have a living ecology at the same time. But you're right. I think taxation is absolutely critical. We need inheritance taxes. We probably need transaction taxes. Slow down some of this, you know, ridiculous investment trading that's going on. You're absolutely right. We shouldn't have billionaires, and you shouldn't have, you know, children inheriting this obscene wealth. I mean, some inheritance is fine, but right, we don't want dynasties.
No, because my point is you know, you could name a whole bunch of our billionaires today. You've got Musk and you got Bezos and you got all of them. You know, you can't name a bunch of them from the 1950s because mm-hmm. we didn't have a whole bunch of them. And what's frustrating to me is we've been told that the benevolence, the philanthropy of our billionaire class will solve some of our problems. Well, they haven't. As you've pointed out, Bill Gates could solve problems. He could leave a legacy of being of someone who eradicated, you know, debt to foreign countries. You know, Jeff Bezos could end child poverty. You could get Elon Musk, who could end homelessness. We could end problems with the kind of wealth that these people have. They just choose not to because benevolence doesn't work.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, we need to look at, well, what's the system that creates that wealth? And actually, what I would say, the system that extracts that wealth is more accurate. It's not really creating wealth for the most part. It's extracting it from the rest of us. I mean, look at, for example, these big tech companies, you know, Google and Facebook and so on. When they hit a downturn not too long ago, what's the first thing that they did? Their stock turned down. They threw thousands of workers out of work. That was the very first thing they did, because that fattens the bottom line, and the bottom line determines your share price. So it's a direct transfer of wealth. And so we need to look at that system, Rick, and we need to say, no, we can't have this system anymore. We can still have corporations, we can still have investments, and of course we need better tax system, but we can move to a different kind of system, and I think it's high time.
And I think we can return to a production-based economy instead of a paper-shuffling economy, a Wall Street economy. I want a factory town. I want a small town America that has a Main Street. I'm tired of the Wall Street economy that's been screwing over working people for the last couple of generations.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's been a concerted war on workers, and it's a war by capital. To fatten its own coffers by degrading workers. And we need to see that as a unified phenomenon that it is. You know, when you're sending jobs overseas, or you're laying people off, or you're creating gig jobs that are no longer full-time work, all of that is part of the war on workers. And, you know, unions, it should be, if you want to join a union, it should be as easy to join a union as it is to join a mutual fund, right? If you want it, you should be able to have it. And it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy that companies fight unions. The right to join a union is a universal human right. This was recognized back in 1948. They shouldn't be fighting universal human rights. That's crazy.
This for me comes back down to a legislative agenda that I would hope working people would get on board with. The ability to join and form unions should be as easy as it was when my grandparents were in the heart of their working lives. A sane and rational tax code where the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry, the more society expects, because the more you take away from, the more you extract from the economy, the more is expected of you. I mean, some common sense truths of the past, but updated for the future, because you're right. Our economy has changed a bit because we do have more gig workers. But, you know, we had them back 100 years ago, too. And we made laws to be able to ensure that we protected people. I think we can do that again.
Well, we certainly need to find a lot of ways to do it again, Rick. And I would love to see workers have a voice in the boardroom, too. I think that's the kind of power that we need to be ultimately heading for.
Without question, you know, and I absolutely like to have in Germany, where you have workers on the board who are making decisions for the working people as well. Absolutely. The book Wealth Supremacy, right. The Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drives Today's Crisis by Marjorie Kelly. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. What kind of response you've been getting to this? I mean, you know, when you're talking about some pretty radical stuff here, and I'm sure the socialism word's been thrown at you. How dare you talk about socialism?
Oh, yeah. You know, first of all, I reject the idea that our choices are binary. That's either capitalism or socialism. I think that we need something that's beyond those. Both of those are like 150 years old. So you said, how's it being received? Very well. There's a lot of interest. I mean, we had a launch event at the Aspen Institute in Washington, D.C. You know, we had 600 people sign up. You know, that's that's not a radical organization. And yet they really saw merit in these arguments and this idea of system change. So, Rick, I think we're in different times. I think we're going to start to see rising interest in system change and getting serious about building economy for the rest of us.
Because, look, I think, you know, what built the most prosperous class, working class in the history of civilization during my grandparents' generation was brought about because literally workers were ripping this country apart brick by brick. I mean, there were strikes all over. There were sit-down strikes. There was chaos in this country. The National Labor Relations Act was a peace treaty to get workers to stop striking and causing chaos. And you're seeing workers back in the streets like we haven't seen in generations. So, you know, right now, a conversation on how we restructure an economy to ensure that working people get a fair share of the wealth that their labor creates probably could be received by folks in the corporate boardroom, because I don't know that they want to see their heads on platters, or, you know, as the Sean Fain t-shirt said, I don't think they want to be eaten.
I'm hopeful that the time is right for a deeper kind of conversation. Unions are needed, you know, absolutely. And we need even more fundamental power. We need to own companies. We need to have a seat in the boardroom. And like you said, we need to tax away the wealth of these absurd billionaires. I think we can get there, Rick. I think if we work together and start to have conversations like this, I think people are ready.
Yeah, but it all comes back down to politics, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But it's also true that you need to build the models that work. And a lot of that work is happening in the private sector. In fact, you know, impact investors are real players in this too. So it's not only policy that drives this. There's a huge movement for impact investing for racial equity and for ecological sustainability and for worker gains. I mean, investors there's money to be made as an investor in converting existing companies to worker ownership. There's some really exciting models that are happening in that arena. And you could have federal policies that support that and accelerate that kind of movement.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm excited about the potential of a positive future and changes that you talk about in this book. I hope folks will take a look at it. It's called Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis by Marjorie Kelly. She is a distinguished senior fellow over at the Democracy Collaborative. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at the book. Marjorie, as always, I appreciate you taking some time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Let's do it, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
Outstanding stuff. Again, Wealth Supremacy. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at the book. Highly, highly suggest it. Gotta take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. More working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
got to tell you, no, I'm all on board with the idea of worker-owned collaboratives. I'm all on board with the idea of workers owning the factors of production and having a say on the job. I'm just not seeing it happening on a large enough scale to compete with these big corporate interests, especially now as you're seeing, you know, these hedge funds and all of these groups that are just, you know, just raising obscene amounts of money. I mean, seriously, just obscene amounts of money, buying up housing, buying up everything they can. And this is where it comes back to. We need to have some bit of, some bit of regulatory oversight to make sure that we don't have the kind of monopolization that we've been seeing. Just a thought. We'll see. Let's go to the phones. We got John on line one from Madison. John, how are you?
Hey, I'm well. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind, brother?
Yeah, I was just listening here, and I'm really not familiar with your show, but I heard you talk about gazillionaires, and I just was, I'm thinking the problem here is more with inflation. And I'm looking up Henry Ford's wealth adjusted for inflation, and he possessed $200 billion in today's valuing. So
and when was Henry Ford?
The problem is not necessarily, these gazillionaires. It's the printing press and the inflation. And the solution for that is Bitcoin, quite honestly, because it's capped at 21 million coins.
Yeah, I'm not going there with
distributed.
You.
Well, I already went there.
Okay. Congratulations.
I'm living there.
All right.
Huh?
Good. Is
so
it working for you?
I mean, either way, yeah, it is. And either way, good. We have to address the inflation and the printing press. That is the problem. You know, politics, I don't think, is going to solve the problem. Socialism or capitalism, you know, we've experimented with those for quite a while. And I'm not sure if I was cut off, but yeah, I really believe Bitcoin is a solution. I encourage everybody to just give it a fair look.
All right. Good stuff. You got your ad in. Thanks,
okay.
John.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. I'm not a digital coin guy, but yeah, some people are. I've had some people who say they did really well. I've had some people who say they lost their shirt. That's up to you. Now, Henry Ford, you go, okay, well, Henry Ford was his wealth created before a lot of the taxation. And to my point, you know, name the Gilded Age billionaires. You know, name those billionaires from the teens and before. You can name a bunch of them, can't you? Then you go into the 50s and the 60s. You know, who were they? There weren't those kind of extreme wealth individuals because we taxed them. And we took that money and we invested in infrastructure. We paid for our wars. We invested in communities. We invested in building this country. And oh, by the way, corporations paid workers. You know, part of the whole giving massive tax breaks to corporations, it just meant that they put more money in their pockets as opposed to going, no, I don't want to give it to the government. We're going to pay higher wages. And oh, by the way, we had stronger unions back then to demand higher wages. That was a huge part of this as well. So in looking where we are and where we're heading, for the working people of this country, wages have been stagnant for a couple of decades. You know, what, five now? So in looking at Marjorie's book, the hope is that there is a way forward to make work pay, to have a reward for work. Or, you know, I love hearing my Republican friends say, nobody wants to work anymore. I hear this a lot. Nobody wants to work anymore. Well, nobody wants to work for poverty, wages, and desperate conditions. And, you know, I go back to that Timothy Gurney guy who said, you know, we need massive unemployment. We need to get those working people back into line because they like a desperation economy. And my fear is as we move to the AI and the robotics and all this stuff that we're so far behind, that they get their wish because we've done nothing to address what's coming. Nothing. So we'll see where this goes. But again, the book If you want to take a look at it, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Written by Marjorie Kelly over at the Democracy Collaborative. Got lots more to get to. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. If you got something that I said got on your under your skin, on your nerves, under your mind, or just made you think, I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Here's my suggestion for stopping the ultra-right-wing loopiness coming out of the mouths of Republican officials. Hearing aids. I'm convinced that the wacko blatherings of Matt Gaetz, the ravings of the QAnon cult, Trump's tantrums, and so many others are the result of a tragic neurological disconnect. This affliction lets their tongues wag impulsively, but their ears don't pick up the noise, so they're unaware that they are prattling nonsense. The current chaos in Congress's Republican caucus is one embarrassing example of this eardrum contagion, but it has spread throughout the country, even to local right-wing officials. In Shasta County, California, for example, the Republican-controlled Board of Supervisors recently lurched into full-tilt screwballism, frenetically warning that Japanese forces are weaponizing mosquitoes to be, quote, flying syringes to mass-inject Americans. See? No way they would have said that if they could hear themselves. Which brings us to the fount of present-day right-wing goofiness, Texas state officials. Their latest tone-deaf ploy is by Governor Greg Abbott, who wants to divert our people's tax dollars from public schools to exclusive private academies, subsidizing the rich class he serves. He's tried to do this before, but he fails, since even conservative Republicans in rural counties don't want their public education turned over to profiteering corporate chains. So this time, Greg is hyping privatization as a, quote, religious freedom issue, piously preaching that, quote, God created us to have family units, not state bureaucrats, make decisions for families. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, does Abbott even have ears? Or maybe he's hoping that we don't have memories, for we have heard him howling constantly that the state, not families, must make every woman's personal reproductive decisions. Let's buy a hearing aid for him and set it on a constant replay loop.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today there was a massive crowd of working people out in the streets in New York City at the site of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire Memorial. There was a dedication today as workers remembered the 1911 fire that killed more than, killed 146 working people, mostly women, mostly immigrants, young women, many who jumped to their deaths because, the factory owner didn't want them stealing little scraps. You know, you don't want that happening. Don't want your scraps stolen. So they locked the exit doors so that when the fire broke out, no way to get out. And again, this is one of those tragedies of the past where you go, this is how we got the regulations that we have in place today. The people who died for the regulations that we kind of not just take for granted, but end up in a lot of cases, you hear people mocking or somehow, being angry over. But you had, thousands of people out in the streets today. And this is a big deal. And I've been to the building that the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire happened. It's now it's a science building, I think, for NYU in downtown New York City. And when we did our people's tour back in, I think it was 2013, we ended up going through and taking a tour of the building and looking down. And it's one of those things where, as I'm looking down, to the ground and all the way, from the 7th and 8th floor, looking down and then imagining there being this burning fire that you cannot escape from. This just horrible situation that you can't get away from because you're locked in. You are trapped. Your only options are you're going to burn to death or you're going to jump to your death. Imagine putting yourself in that situation. Imagine how horrible that is. But like I said, today there was a dedication, a memorial for those 146 workers who perished because of this. And here to share some thoughts on the day's events and share some thoughts on what it took to get to this, because this was no small feat. I've asked Suzanne Pred-Bass to come talk with us. She is a board member of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition. She's the great niece of Rosie Wiener, who died in the Triangle Factory fire, and also Kate Wiener, who was one of the folks who did get out. Suzanne, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm really happy to be here.
So tell me about today's event. I saw video. I saw some of the speeches. I saw people, talking. I talked to somebody who was there. This was an impressive event, wasn't it?
It was extraordinary. This was 12 years in the making, Rick. We began the idea of this memorial 12 years ago. We had a huge international competition with over 180 designs submitted. A panel jury of top people in the field, and then raised money like crazy, and went through city bureaucracy nightmares in order to get permissions and pass through landmarks. And I mean, you have an idea of what it takes. And now there is on the Brown Building, which is the building that the fire took place in. It is owned by NYU, and they allowed us to put it on this building. It used to be called the Ash Building. How about that for a pun? ASCH spelt, but it's stunning. I wish you could just jump over and see it. It's got two panels. It's got names cut out that are reflected down. You can't imagine. When it was described to me, I wasn't sure, how is that going to work? But these names are reflected down on a lower panel that has quotes from people who were at the actual fire. And, then you've got all the names and the ages and translations in Yiddish and Italian, because those were the languages of these young, mostly immigrant women workers. And, you know, it's just phenomenal, you know. And today there was huge crowd there. I understand about 2,000. Yeah. I wasn't counting. I was too busy doing other stuff. But, you know, they lined up and, you know, went carefully around, and people were incredibly moved by it. It's stunning. It is changing the landscape of New York City.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Because I've been to the Brown Building. You know, back in 13, we did a labor history tour, and one of the places we stopped was with the building, and they were nice enough to allow us to go through the area that had been, you know, where the fire was, and, you know, gave us a kind of a halfway guided tour, if you will. And, you know, the floor where most of the people unfortunately perished is now like a science lab, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a little eerie because, you know, it's got the same long tables, you know, that they had in the factory, only this time they're sort of labs with microscopes and, you know, little, you know, desks for people to work on, but the same long tables row after row that had sewing machines in 1911.
So, you know, this has been, you know, the legacy of your family for, you know, for your lifetime. What has this meant to you over your lifetime, and what does this dedication and this monument mean to you now?
You know, my daughter said to me, and I'm so fortunate because, you know, I've been able to do many, many terrific and satisfying things in my life. But she said, "Mom, this is your life's work." And I do feel like I carry a mantle for my family, particularly my great aunts, my great grandmother, my mother, that whole generation that suffered this, you know, cataclysmic tragedy, this unexpected, unfathomable, unnecessary loss of lives that traumatized them, you know, for the rest of their lives. My mother, at the age of 4, was taken by her mother to what was called the Charity Piers to identify Rosie's body. Now, you can imagine what that did to a 4-year-old, hearing the shrieks, seeing the charred bodies. She never forgot, and she carried that. And, you know, I just am so filled with gratitude that I was able to be part of this process of this amazing group, the Triangle, Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition board, who have worked relentlessly and with such dedication to make this happen. And I really feel like I spoke today at the ceremony, and I quoted from a union report, because even though these louses, I'll call them that, would not allow the shop to become a union shop, many of these young workers were union workers. So there was actually a union visit to my family's house after Rosie died. And my great-grandmother said, you know, that Rosie had saved $400 in, I don't know how many years, probably 5-6 years of work. So you figure 50 cents to a dollar a week she was sometimes putting away. And it was, I know from other sources that Rosie wanted to move out of the city and have a farm. But her mother said, "This has to go for a monument for her." And here I am, and we are finally building this monument that even back then, I mean, she didn't have this vision, but she had a longing for it.
Yeah. And also, you know, so that no one forgets about it, and that we learn the lessons of history and never allow it to happen again.
Yeah, well, would that would be the case. You know, we had people from Turkey, Cambodia, Bangladesh who came to this today, and, you know, there are workers all through those countries in South America, and we can find them in our own country, that are working in intolerable, unsafe, fire trap conditions and locked in, you know, the same circumstances. But yes, this is a vibrant, powerful call to people to remember and also to be inspired to look to what our labor history is and what we must not repeat.
You know, back in 2013, we did a cross-country labor history tour. And we went, you know, all the way out to California, up to Washington and back again. We did 9,800 miles in 30 days, seeking out labor's history, wrote a book out of it, did all kinds of stuff. And the one thing that remained constant is in places where labor's history was, where it was allowed to be, it was sanitized with corporate speak in a lot of places, or it was eviscerated entirely. We went to Blair Mountain, where the Battle of Blair Mountain happened, and they literally removed all of the history, brick by brick, every building, every road, everything. They even wanted to remove the mountain. So to have a bit of history where there's labor's behind it, I think is so very important, especially in something on a tragedy that is this important.
Yeah. You know, it was the biggest workplace tragedy in American history until 9/11. So it was huge. And, you know, had you been there today, all the SAG-AFTRA workers were told not to be on picket lines. They were told to go there to the ceremony today. And there were union people just, you know, by the hundreds there, and so many young people. And they are the ones that this is speaking to. And that is crucial.
So last question I've got for you. Obviously, as we've been saying, this has been your life's work. This has been your family legacy. What do you hope people take from this? What do you hope the future holds for this? What's your vision for what people take from it?
Well, you know, it's twofold. People have to be moved by the enormity of this tragedy, by the loss of these young lives, you know, left their houses one morning and never returned. And they were and speak to so many of the issues that we still, like I've said, are relevant today. It's immigrant issues, it's women issues, it's laborer issues, it's safety issues, you know, so many things. And I hope, you know, people, come away with the sense, like you said, we can't let anything like this happen again. We have to look at injustice where we see it, and we have to take it on.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Suzanne, you know, great work. I saw some of the images. I hope folks will go to rememberthetrianglefire.org. We'll get links on social media. You can take a look at the website. You know, just incredible work on your end. Congratulations for getting this done. And I appreciate you taking a little time for us to share.
Thank you, Rick. I'm really glad you're paying attention to this.
No, this is really important, and I give you the utmost credit. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, Suzanne. Again, this is another one of those things. I hope you'll take a look at it. rememberthetrianglefire.org, the website. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'll take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. 50,000 people gathered in the small town of Mount Olive in southern Illinois. They had come to commemorate a new memorial to renowned labor leader Mother Jones and to honor mine workers who had lost their lives. 5 special trains and 25 Greyhound buses helped to bring the crowd to the Union Miners Cemetery. The cemetery was founded as a resting place for fallen miners. In 1898, in the town of Verdun,
Verdun, violence erupted. Remembered as the Verdun Massacre, seven miners were shot dead at the hands of company-hired guns. Four of the murdered miners were from Mount Olive. The miners were originally laid to rest at the town's burial plot, but the owners of the cemetery objected to the ceremonies that the union held there. So, the local miners' union purchased land and moved three of their brothers to the new union cemetery. When Mother Jones died at the age of 100 in 1930, she asked to be buried with her boys at the cemetery. The miners raised more than $16,000 for a monument. The 22-foot-tall obelisk is made of 80 tons of pink Minnesota granite. On the obelisk is a medallion bearing the likeness of Mother Jones. She is guarded on either side by a larger-than-life bronze statue of a coal miner with his sledge. In 2015, a crowd of 300 gathered for a rededication of the monument. Illinois AFL-CIO and the United Mine Workers of America spearheaded the campaign to raise $100,000 to restore the site. One of those who attended the rededication was Bill Felica, a local retired miner. He told a reporter, "Mother Jones is like a local hero. She wasn't afraid to stand up to the big shots like judges and politicians. She was just a hellraiser." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. I got to tell you, looking at the images of this monument in New York, I'm looking forward to getting back to the city to take a look at this. And as I said before, I've been to the Brown Building in the past, and if I remember, there had been a marker, commemorating that this was the site. There had been just a plaque on the side of the building. But this is something, much, much, much different, something much, much better. And look, at the end of the day, the hope is that the more we reclaim our history, especially labor's history, because, I go back to our labor history tour of 2013, where we wrote the book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? In the places where we went, all across the country, where there was still allowed to be labor history, it had been sanitized. And one of the places, we went to Martinsburg, West Virginia, the site of the beginning of the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, was at this roundhouse in Martinsburg. At least this is where they say it. There's conflicting arguments happen in Baltimore, other places, but Martinsburg was pretty much the place where most people said that started. And we were told, there's a marker there. There's stuff there. We were told. So we went and we scoured the roundhouse. Nothing. All about how wonderful the roundhouse was. Talked about the fire. Didn't talk about, what happened. Talked about that there was a fire, it burned down, they rebuilt it. But not anything about labor, nothing. And, the whole place. And as we were about ready to leave, one of my kids said, "Hey, there's something down at the end of this alley," and pointed to a sign and at the end of the alley. So we walked down to the end of this alley and there's a placard and it's about the roundhouse. And I'm like, "Well, that's still about the roundhouse." I jump up on the guardrail. I look at the other side of it. On the other side of it, there was the placard that commemorated the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. So in order to read it, we had to go back, walk the half a mile back into the roundhouse, go back in through the roundhouse, back off, jump off the platform, walk along the railroad track that, just about a half a mile almost, and then look up 10 feet. And that is where the sanitized version, the corporate speak version of labor's history was found. And that should have been, the telltale sign of what was to come. Because unfortunately, this is what corporate America has gotten away with. And look, the moneyed interests have done a great job of ensuring that labor education never gets near our kids in school, that they never learn anything about the history of work or workers in this country. In fact, you know, I tell it all the time, you know, in school, the only thing that I ever learned about labor history was the Molly Maguires. And we were taught that they were criminals. Also taught that they didn't exist. So they were criminals, but they didn't exist. A whole bunch of stuff. Nothing about the ancient order of Hibernians. They were the Molly Maguires, and they were criminals. So much more complicated. And this is where, you know, as a labor person, as someone who has studied a bit of our history, it's a lot more complicated and a lot more bloody and violent. The path to a middle class, the path to prosperity that we take for granted today, you know, we take as a birthright almost, this good fortune we've been born into. It was brought to us because generations before us fought, bled, and died for it. You know, the regulations that we swear at now, the unions that people mock or degrade, that's what built a prosperous working class. You know, I hear people say, no, my hard work, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Nonsense. You go back and you read labor's history of people working, you know, 70 hours a week, sun up to sun down, 6 days a week, owing their life to the company store and never getting out of debt. And if we spent time remembering the past, which is why, you know, you listen to the right's attack on education. A big part of that, you know, the whole attack on CET or CRT or CTR, or, I don't know, it's a theory about race that's critical or something. The whole attack on that is about, we don't want to learn about history. We don't want to learn complicated, difficult history. We want jingoism. We want talking points. We want happy stuff. We were the good guys. We, you know, benevolence. We want, you know, rich guys who were benevolent. Andrew Carnegie was a good guy. He brought us libraries. Never mind all of the history around, you know, what he did to his workforce. Never mind any of that. Never mind him and Frick and the Homestead Strike and never mind any of that stuff. He funded libraries. So for me, this is part of when I see something like this monument, I see this as a victory for working people, because this is going to be an opportunity for people to live a bit of history, to go, hey, maybe question, why is this here? And I'll tell you, I don't think labor has done a good enough job of talking about its history. I don't think labor has done a good enough job of promoting what it took to build the most prosperous working class in history, what it took to fight for the 8-hour day, what it took to fight for minimum wage, for weekends, for vacations, for days off, for health care, for retirement security, for any of those things. I don't think they've done a good job at all in telling those stories. What we end up getting is the corporate speak. The benevolent corporation gives us these wonderful things out of the goodness of their hearts. It's amazing to me how many people think that even in union environments, that the wages, hours, and conditions that they get are because the company is good to them. Or that some invisible hand has created this environment. Some benevolent invisible hand, which I got to tell you, curious to me. So I think this is a good thing, and I'm looking forward to seeing the Triangle Memorial. I'm looking to see I got to get there. This is one of those. It's now a pilgrimage thing. I'm going to have to make a specific trip just for this. I wish I would have known this was going on today, and because we would have made a trip out today. It's important stuff. Now, tomorrow, will we get a speaker? Is there a speaker to be had? There are some signs of positivity. Jordan has said he's out. He's going to throw his support behind.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.